So let me invite the members of the panel, please, at the table together. And I'm going to open the floor for questions.
We're going to be missing chairs, obviously.
No. Where did they go? There were five here this morning. There's two at the end.
Or six.
Two more. You can film the warmth and the passion here together with the heat of being all together. I mean, it's okay. I will start.
Thank you.
With microphone on my right.
I'm Dr. Anil Joshi from India. This session is very, very important, and of course, the other session that we had yesterday, very important, and we are enlightened a lot. Couple of suggestions come. Number one is, definitely, the global security is a very important issue. And we agree that ultimately it is the most important stakeholder are farmers. Anything we talk, ultimately it is the farmers. The science we talk, policy, planning, management, it is ultimately the farmers. Now, what my suggestion is that when we have global food security centric discussion, the many issues, shooting prices are consumers rather issue, the farmers issues are low prices. And there are certainly many other issues. What my suggestion is that, of course, global food security besides, it should be farmer-centric discussion. Because ultimately, it is the farmers we have to come up with, and anything we talk about, and the global security or surplus or deficit, it is the farmer's role is. And therefore, along with the global security kind, we should seriously think it should be rather farmer-centric. Number two is, this gathering, which I was wondering, and it was definitely to have a very good discussion among the scientists and the planners. Equally important, we have the representation from across the world. We are talking of food farmers. Equally important would be if we can also think a gathering of the farmers of across the world and equally discuss, because they are the ultimate stakeholder. Unfortunately, we agree that we have been representing farmer one other way, but the true partnership and participation can only come when we also gather them on the issues. At least they also should have, as the scientists have a common opinion we built after a 2 days discussion, there must be farmers gathering, and their association at least will have many, many impacts. And the most important and the last one is, definitely we have been talking of management. Scientists, we want a farmers to become a scientist. Policy maker want the farmers to do a good planning and policy for their product. And also, similarly, the good managers talk about the management. But to me, it is equally important, before advising the farmers, equally important that we will have to become a farmers to advise them very correctly. So this is three of my suggestions, and at least for the last one, the youth who have gathered here want to do something for the farmers, they will have to become a farmers to give a right suggestion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Would you like to... Any at the table make a comment?
Thank you for your comment. I think that there are mechanisms by which farmers do come together, and among others, because we have in the room here, I would suggest that the representative from the International Fund for Agriculture Developments here may wish to speak to you, because they have made a dramatic change in the 90s from having a group of NGOs, as many international agencies and banks have had NGO advisory groups. They moved from that to having a farmers forum, saying that given what they are doing, they really need to hear and engage with the farming population. So it may be a place to start to move forward your very important suggestion.
I don't know if that's good.
that's working.
Well, just to add to this, I mean, there is an international organization for farmers. I mean, unfortunately, the one that existed for several, almost 100 years, the International Federation of Agricultural Producers, who were doing a lot of work in environment and development work and so on, went bankrupt about 3 years ago, three, 4 years ago. There's a new organization called the World Farmer Organization, now based in Italy, that has just been is still in its infancy, I would say. But these forums exist, and I agree with you. I want to make a point about your first comment about the issue should be farmer-centric, because I'm not comfortable with this, to be quite frank. And I'm not comfortable with this to the extent that every time we talk about food crisis, and Sergi, in your presentation, all the tools that were used were about agriculture. We've gone through achieved food policies after the Second World War because Europe couldn't feed themselves and so on, and we're still paying for having kept cheap food, you know, all through the process. And we shifted this this focus onto the farmers. And when I, you know, I'm more Canadian in terms of the development of this industry, which is very healthy and doing very well. I'm very proud of it. But we achieved self-sufficiency in 1976. And the only reason we achieved self-sufficiency is because we increased and regulated the price that the farmers would get in 1975. That's the only way in this country that we achieve self-sufficiency. But in 1976, and I was there, in 1976, I'm showing my age, we only had to address one issue. We only had to address income of farmers. And we fixed the problem. Once the income was there, production went up. 20% in one year, 20% increase in 1 year. This is really quick. But we didn't have to address environment, we didn't have to address biodiversity, we didn't have to address the rights of women, we didn't have to address the distribution, we didn't have to address the land use. When you look into developing countries, we're putting so much on the plate of what we're trying to do to develop an agricultural base that we need to go back to the simple things. Yes, of course, you need some basic infrastructure, no debate here. But go back and deal with the income of farmers, and then you will achieve far more impact by addressing that, and the other issues will come afterwards. But trying to do it all at the same time, I think we're chewing too much.
Thank you very much, Peter. This side, question on this side.
My name is Leanne Zerda. I'm from the University of Stellenbosch in South Africa. I want to thank Mr. Moore and the previous question, actually, because it opens up a lot of the issues that I've been worried about. We talk about food security, but we never mention food sovereignty. And we cannot talk about the societal actors without talking about the poor and the landless, and none of those people are represented in our room here, as the previous speaker mentioned as well. I'm also surprised that social movements such as La Via Campesina have not been mentioned at all during this forum. And so this leads to my question on how do we, as academics and managers of programs internationally, how do we reorient our thinking from charity handouts in the form of aid to supporting initiatives of food sovereignty, and a term that I really like from yesterday is scientific sovereignty. Thank you.
Please help me.
Only in the hope that others will take the microphone, but since the question was directed my way. I'm not prepared to or feel well equipped to deal with the question of food sovereignty. As important as it is, I think that development, as we in the North try to work with people who we believe have the potential to redress the inequalities and problems in the South, the first and primary area that we must work on is based upon the principle that people must be empowered to be the agents of their own development. And we therefore need to examine how we can help to strengthen the institutions of communities, be they farmers, be they women, indigenous people, landless workers, agriculture workers. The issue is that they need to be in a position of influence about their public policies. And if the issue is food sovereignty and how that should be manifest, then they are the ones that have to make that decision. I'll give you an example without going on. In 1995, the Food and Agriculture Organization, being the UN agency that was founded before the UN, I might mention, held its 50th anniversary in Quebec City. I was the director of the Canadian Hunger Foundation, which was the organization that grew out of that work here in Canada, and therefore was asked to coordinate the non-governmental meeting in Quebec City. The most significant thing that came out in the meeting was when a group of peasant farmers, they may have been with La Via Campesina or they may have been fisher folk, stood up in the NGO meeting and said, those of you in this room think that the major problem that we face is with the governments that are meeting up in the Chateau Frontenac. But many of you in this room are our larger problem, because those of you in the north, thinking that you are helping with us, take away our voice, speak to the international community on our behalf, interpret our reality according to your models of development. So if you really want to help us, there's one of two things you can do. Either you use the influence that you have to create opportunities for us to be at the table, or get out of the way, because we're going to have to find our own place so that our voice, our credibility, and the legitimacy that we represent the poor gets into the international dialogue. That's why I say it's for them to decide what is the food strategy that needs to be taken, and we need to use our influence to strengthen their organizations to be at the table and to negotiate according to the ways they think the negotiation should proceed.
Thank you, Bruce. Anybody else? Question on this side, please. No?
Yeah, I would have a comment / question for Mr. Moore. You've mentioned that capital-rich countries invest in developing countries in order to bring food prices down at home. That would require basically competitive food production in these countries, which is, my experience, is simply not the case. So these investments require a lot of subsidies, and actually, if we take a look at the Gulf, all these agro-businessmen, they basically jockey for positions and to get subsidies. Otherwise, it's simply not a good business proposition. And in that context, I have to say some of the numbers that are brought forward by NGOs like the International Land Coalition and, for example, the land matrix that you have just launched are simply highly inflated and misleading. For example, in the land matrix at the start, there were basically projects like Deru in Madagascar or ZTE for palm oil production in Congo, projects that have never taken place yet, just announcements. So there's simply a huge gap for the Gulf countries. I know it firsthand, but for China, Deborah Breutigam has outlined a similar case. Just to give you an example, this Ethiopian rice production and export to Saudi Arabia in 2009. These were just a couple of boxes, hardly enough to feed this room, not to mention Saudi Arabia. Ethiopia is not a rice exporter to the Gulf, and most likely it will never be. Apparently, Al Amudi, the project owner, has gotten cold feet now because there was an attack on this project and five people got killed. So it shows, yes, a lot of these projects, problems that you are mentioning are there. Alienation of customary land rights holder, but at the same time we simply do not have this all out dispossession that is sometimes portrayed, and I'm for reasons that we need to dig deeper. It's simply not such a great business opportunity, and in some cases there are a lot of development impediments, and maybe we should think about, okay, can we maybe find a middle way between a large scale agro project and smallholders that receive investments, because romanticizing subsistence farming is certainly not the way as well. So I think I really like your work at the International Land Coalition and other NGOs, but these kind of, in the land grab debate, these large numbers that are being dished out and this taking of media reports as at face value is really a problem. It gives a misleading picture.
Thank you.
Before I reply, will the next speaker direct the question to somebody else? Your point is well taken, but I would have to respond by saying, yes, you may have better information than I do there. By the way, I should mention that I've been retired as the director of the Land Coalition for 4 years, so therefore I do not speak on their behalf. I speak on the, I am confident to speak in the period which, for which I was the director. Look at the membership of the International Land Coalition. All the key actors are there. The World Bank is a member of the board, the European Commission. They have all agreed to consolidate all of the information on land acquisitions under a website of the Land Coalition. If we look at the major researchers throughout the United States, the number that are doing research trying to understand the issue of land acquisitions is extensive. So while it may be true, it would also be untrue for people to go away and conclude, therefore, that the issue of land acquisitions is not an issue. Go to the literature. The literature is extensive, and it's supported by many to look at it. I am not in a position to defend any one particular case. My point was to raise the fact that we need to look at these issues, and I think this has come up regularly by other speakers, and I think they're very, what you have raised, I would say people should pay heed to what you have mentioned, not relative necessarily to the Ethiopian, but to the complexities of supporting production systems. And it's not a matter of smallholders versus commercial. There are often ways in which to enter the value chain. It's the relationship of the two. So you're quite correct in pointing that out. But I cannot let the audience go away and conclude that that it's you said, I said about the Ethiopian situation. Go to the literature and draw your own conclusions about the extent of this, and also factor in the extremely important point made about land acquisitions. Is it necessarily land grabbing, as some would like to present it, by foreign investors, or are they fairly acquiring land, and the issues of the legal ability to acquire that land may be within the countries themselves?
Thank you, Bruce. This side, please.
Yep. Thank you. My name is Alexander Clausen. I am a business exchange student here at McGill University, and I would be interested to know your opinion on biofuels. So it's a growing market. Until 2016, it's supposed to be, double in revenue. And on one side, I can imagine it's a threat as it's taking away food. And on the other side, it also can be an opportunity as food prices may rise. So maybe you can elaborate how biofuel is developing in your different countries. Thank you.
Yeah, you answered 90% of the question probably, right? You said it's a threat and an opportunity, yes. But I guess what the problem is from the bank point of view with the biofuel policies, I guess, is the additional income to farmers is just unfortunately it coincides with the increase in demand in Asia. So for food, if you would not have increasing demand for Asia for food, so maybe the biofuel demand would not be as dramatic as we see it right now. But the problem is when you try to produce biofuels not in the places for comparative advantage, and when you use the mandates. The global food system, the global food demand is very inelastic, so the people need to eat irrespective of the price. So biofuels can potentially increase elasticity of demand. If you don't have mandate, you have that elastic part of demand, so when the demand for food goes up and down and it's reflected in the biofuels demand, then you have the larger improved elasticity of demand in the whole system. But when you have the mandate, you need to consume food, you need to consume feeder irrespective of the price. You just have to. There is the mandate. So it makes food systems demand even less elastic than we had before. So if you reduce your elasticity of demand, you have any supply shock will bring you larger price spike. Simple as that. I mean, we are here at the university. I can talk in the words elasticity price spike, right? You understand me. So this is where the problem is. The biofuels is fine where it's economically productive, fine. There are sustainability concerns can be addressed. But for the global system, food security relevant to this conference, mandate, reduce elasticity, and induce price spikes. Point.
Thank you. Next question.
Hello. My name is Mohamed Bakari. I'm a PhD student with Bioresource Engineering. at McGill University. I know that land issue is one of the major causes of conflicts in sub-Saharan Africa between farmers and the nomads there. And my question is, how can the sub-Saharan African subsistence farmers and traditional nomadic livestock producers deal with the pressures of the increase in globalization and commercialization? Also, how will the collaboration between these two groups help them in addressing this issue of globalization and globalization and commercialization?
I guess I worked in Uganda, Tanzania, Zambia, and South Sudan for 4 years. Different problems, different countries, but there are some also common topics. This one is big in Kenya, Sudan, right? Clarifying land rights. It's only probably 5% of land titles are issued in Africa, and before you move that agenda, it's impossible to think about the equal distribution or the sort of avoiding the conflicts. If you don't clarify land rights, who what belongs to whom, and the governments are very slow in this. I don't know why, there are different reasons. But until you do that, this conflict will prevail because of the large population growth in these areas. Thank you.
Further to what has just been mentioned, I think one of them relates to what we're hearing here. We're seeing a combination of social, political, but also technical and scientific information. And clearly, if we take Kenya as an example, the amount of semi-arid land that those who could get access tried to turn into farming and ranch land shows high levels of failure because of the intensive use of the land. So there is a lot of work that's been done on the land rights question that has tried to look at the economic and livelihood systems of nomadic pastoralists, showing that in fact many of the past efforts resulted in sedentarization, because as people who were concerned with the wider set of needs and requirements that communities were facing to improve their situation, the physical establishment of schools, clinics, and other services resulted in people not being able to travel as far, and therefore the entire agroecological base of that style, that livelihood system broke down. So we ended up with some innovative things. There's an organization that when I was with the Hunger Foundation, we worked with Farm Africa, and the Sir Michael Wood, who started the Flying Doctors, made massive inroads with pastoralists and with groups wanting to work with them by taking the fly-in doctor approach and having the people providing services and doing the training move with the nomads so that their way of life was not disrupted. So in some cases, the issue of food security in some of these areas, and I don't know it widely, had to do with working with people on that basis, but doing as we might have seen in the earlier years with the dairy farmers who worked to try to improve breeding stock in other countries. This was occurring with exchanges between camel owners between different parts of the world to improve the productivity per animal, which in arid zones, to look at all of the scientific evidence that has shown how to better get a return on hides, milk, and meat from camels in terms of some of their nutritional and the niche markets. So the issue has a lot to do with how you look at the economic systems and the contribution that pastoralism can provide to overall food supplies in regions where you have these semi-arid conditions, and we need to look at and understand that better.
Yes.
I'm not going to address the African situation, which I'm not an expert in, but the issue of globalization, I think you raised an excellent issue. It goes back to the food food sovereignty issue that was raised before. And I'm going to stick with dairy, which I know. It's one of the most volatile products in the world. Of all agricultural commodities, it has the highest volatility. And there's only 7% of the world production that is exported or traded in any way, shape, or form. Why do we allow that 7% dictate what the conditions for the other 93% will be in all the countries is amazing me. It also amazes me to see that there is not a single developed dairy industry that has achieved self-sufficiency and is on the export market that has not done so through high protection and high subsidy levels. But we're in a round of negotiations right now, that which has lasted 13 years now, that we're trying to tell the developing countries, since it's a developing round, that the developing countries should develop their agriculture with no subsidies and with no trade barriers in a free market system. I think that's hypercritical, to be quite frank. And I don't know how we can manage that, but I think the concept of food sovereignty is what we need to basically embed and let each of the countries decide what they need, just like the developed countries did way back.
If I may add to that discussion on the food subsidies in developing countries versus developed countries very shortly. You know, 1 kilometer of road in Ethiopia costs $700,000 to build. In South Sudan, $1 million to build. 15% of taxes, so if you look at the share of taxes in GDP is 15%. 70% are employed in agriculture. How are you gonna to subsidize it? How you can subsidize 70% of your population when you have only 10% access to electricity, no roads, no water and sanitation? The conflicting demands are huge, immense. The maize in Africa, in South Sudan, costs $1,000 a ton. In Kenya, costs $700,000 a ton. That's a huge price for farmers. But farmers cannot have supply response, not because the prices are low. The prices in Africa are very high. That's why it's import-dependent country, because it has. The problem why the farmers cannot respond, because the government does not invest in public goods, roads, infrastructure, other things. And then you have the budget constraints. So you either provide food subsidies, which are recurrent, which will never produce you capital values, or you invest in the infrastructure. So when we think about developing countries and food subsidization, please let's be very careful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have received not just the evil look, but a physical warning that I have to stop. Can I? One question? There was a lady standing there. I will allow that. But that will be the last one. Okay.
Thank you very much. My name is Nazan Dajne-Desai. I work for the Canada Agriculture Museum. I am also the co-owner of a dairy operation in Eastern Ontario. So my question is for Mr. Doyle.
Well, I guess so.
It has been proven that supply management systems in Canada redistribute wealth fairly between farmers, distributors, transformers. So considering that, to reduce rural poverty and empower farmers around the world, could management systems be implemented in more countries and expanded to other food products? I know we talked about that a little bit yesterday, but I was wondering if you could comment a little.
Very briefly, the reason I say food sovereignty is because I don't necessarily suggest that the model that works here, there's no question that model works here. It is against all the trends globally. But it works. It has worked and continues to work in Canada. And I haven't seen yet any other models, cooperative or otherwise, in the world that has been able to achieve the same objective that we have. At the same time, I'm not going to suggest that everybody has to go supply management. It has worked for us in a time frame within the structure and an evolution of an industry that permitted us to do this. Other commodities in Canada are not even in a position to introduce supply management, even if they wanted to. That's the nature of international agreements and other issues. I think each country has to find their own solution, but we should not preempt through trade agreements or otherwise solution that will fit a certain condition.
Thank you very much. It's been a wonderful panel, don't you think? So I'm going to close it now. Thank you very much to the members. To avoid the riots toward the food tables, I'm going to ask my colleague Caroline Beck to very clear instructions on how we're going to do it now.